Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Who do you believe when it comes to the economy and jobs? Maybe a politician like John Boehner.
This economy went through a very difficult meltdown. And over the course of the last year, the policies that are coming out of this administration have caused us to lose more jobs.
But when politics get involved, the numbers get smudgy. Ask an economist, she'll probably tell you that the economy is growing, unemployment is falling, and we'll probably start adding jobs next month. So who's right? Separating rumor from rhetoric. What's the buzz? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, February 1st, and The Takeaway for me is economists have finally found a way to get people excited about what they do, which is make it kind of a life or death situation for most people.
Well, some economist was behind the budget that comes out this morning, which is going to certainly set the agenda this week. Let's get right to the top stories we're following. President Obama, weekend deficit warrior.
We've heard plenty of talk and a lot of yelling on TV about deficits, and it's now time to come together and make the painful choices we need to eliminate those deficits.
Making those choices starts today when the president unveils his nearly $4 trillion budget. It calls for billions in new spending to combat unemployment while slashing $700 billion for domestic programs. It also raises taxes on banks and people making over $250,000 a year. It's not balanced, though. When the dust settles, the deficit will rise to a record $1.6 trillion this year, almost 11% of the nation's gross domestic product. Economists generally consider deficits above 3% to be unsustainable.
Joining us now, Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times. So, Marcus, when you're looking at the economic numbers, who's the most reliable source?
The most reliable are the actual independent economists and
independent
the congressional budget
economists.
So what you have to do when you want to understand really what's at stake is you have to kind of looking at the partisan economists on the right and left is do what they do in Europe. When they're reading newspapers, you read the right, you read the left, and you average them together and get the center.
Well, we're going to be looking at the center with you in just a moment, so stay with us.
Toyota is telling dealers they should get the parts to fix problematic gas pedals later this week, but the over 4 million customers affected by the recalls over the last few weeks will have to wait for repairs while technicians are trained. In the meantime, dealerships will be open for extended hours. Toyota telling dealers they should get parts to fix those problematic gas pedals later this week. It's a steel fix to the bottom of the gas pedal. Here's Toyota President Jim Lentz.
So I would suggest to a customer that has a sensation that the pedal is slow in returning or that the pedal is not smooth in going down, that they should contact their dealer and get their vehicle in.
That was Lentz, head of Toyota USA, speaking earlier this morning on NBC. In Haiti. That's the sound of orphans singing at a special camp in Port-au-Prince set up for children. Aid agencies are rushing to find thousands of children made homeless by the earthquake, many of whom are still roaming the streets. Meanwhile, flights of injured Haitians to the U.S. for medical treatment will resume today. They'd been suspended because Florida hospitals were overloaded.
For the past 25 years, the main Pentagon strategy has been preparing the military to fight two conventional wars at once. Today, the Pentagon says it will refocus the military on being ready for numerous smaller conflicts at the same time. And it was ladies' night at the Grammys this weekend.
Everywhere I'm looking now, I'm surrounded by your embrace.
That, of course, is Beyonce. She was the big winner. She took home a record 6 awards. She lost Album of the Year, though, to country queen Taylor Swift. Swift got 4 awards at the Grammys. Taking a look at the markets, Asian markets are up, European indices mixed. Futures are up as well. The Dow will start at 10,067, the S&P at 1,073, and the NASDAQ opens at 2147. So we're talking about family today because it's Monday, and we're going to ask you, how can couples stay together longer? Maybe they do it by keeping their money separate. We'll talk about that later.
The president tightens his belt officially in the budget unveiling today. What advice can you glean from, or what advice can you give us about how you trimmed your budget in tough times? What lessons have you learned? Tell us at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, the agenda for this week.
Our our government,
the economy,
put Americans back to work,
freeze government spending,
alternative sources of finance.
Just to give you a sense of perspective.
Good morning. It's Monday morning. Time to take a look at what's on the schedule. What's on the agenda for this week? And here to let us know, Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times. And Rob Watson also joins us, political correspondent for our partner, the BBC. Good morning.
Good morning.
So we're going to be talking a lot about money this week, Marcus, right? I mean, we have a lot of economic numbers coming out, and the job numbers for January are coming out on Friday. So what do you think? Are these numbers for January going to give us a picture for the rest of the year?
In this case, they will. You know, that old saying that when it comes to markets and money, January often sets the course for the year. As goes January, so goes the year. In this case, it will be true for job creation. It's despite the fact that Americans aren't feeling the end of the recession as much as they'd like to, we do expect there to be an increase in jobs this month gaining momentum as the year goes on. Jobs really increasing by the end of the year, a much better feeling amongst the American people and American workers.
So you agree with some analysts who say we're going to actually adding jobs next month?
I'm not going to go there. we are still too close, I think, to the turning point of whether or not we're adding or losing a little bit.
Okay, but what about the markets? Because the S&P stocks had a terrible month in January. Where are the markets going? Is that...
Well, if the markets keep doing what they did in January,
I was going to say
it's going to be a very painful year. Well, you know, you have two things here. You have number one, job creation always follows the economic cycle because it's looking backwards, whereas the markets often precede the economic cycle. So the markets actually are anticipating future profits for corporations and for shareholders. So when they start to go down, that means that people think, well, you know, things don't look so great in the longer term. So it's a kind of looking at two different sides of the train: the top, the beginning of the train, and the end of the train. But secondly, also, last year was a phenomenal year for the markets after a lot of down time, and we expect January this year was a correction that probably won't, you know, presage exactly what happened for the rest of the year, because if it does, we're all going to be a lot poorer, even if we still have jobs.
Well, speaking of being poor, President Obama is set to present his 2011 budget this week. We're going to be talking about that in detail later in the hour. But what do you expect some of the – he's talking about freezing spending. Where do we expect these cuts to be?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the president proposes a budget, and Congress – doesn't actually vote on the whole thing, you know. So he'll propose some cuts that he proposed last year, things like consolidating education programs, things like closing down the kind of abandoned mines program, which gives states money to shut abandoned mines. These are all little things around the edges that last year, again, Congress ignored most of his suggestions on cuts. They spent all the money, you know, he suggested they spend, but they didn't cut as much as he suggested they cut. This is a perennial problem with Congress. This is a president who promised in the State of the Union he's actually going to hold Congress's feet to the fire now and veto spending bills if he has to, unless they come along with the cuts. The Democrats seem very dedicated, so far without Republican support, to reinstate the pay-as-you-go rules, meaning if you add spending, you have to cut somewhere else. If you want to decrease someone's taxes, you have to find cut somewhere else. So we'll see if they actually can bring that back in line. But that's what the Democrats plan to do. Over the long term, you'd reduce this massive record $1.6 trillion deficit that he's going to propose with this year's budget. He would reduce that by 2013 by half. We'll see if they can pull it off, though, because, again, the politics of it are not nearly as easy as the math.
Okay. Rob Watson, let's turn to you. Speaking of international news, because the trial of five American terrorist suspects begins in Pakistan this week, what are we hearing about this trial?
Well, it's certainly a very interesting one for the United States, because it raises this broader issue of, does the United States need to be as worried about homegrown Islamic extremism amongst its Muslim population, particularly those born in places like Pakistan, Egypt, and Somalia, as, for example, governments are very much so in Europe. Now, up to now, as far as I understand this case, the five are accused of wanting to make contact with an extremist Islamic group in the northwest of Pakistan.
They've also complained, these five young Muslims, they disappeared late last year and showed up in Pakistan. They've complained that they've been tortured. Has there been evidence of that?
Well, you know how it is with these kind of cases. You get lots of allegations. There have certainly been many in the past against the Pakistani authorities. They are, of course, incredibly difficult to verify. As things stand, the attitude that the U.S. authorities seem to have over this case is, let's wait and see for the details to come out. But I think it's certainly the case that the FBI were blindsided a bit about this. They apparently first heard of the possible case against these five after their families had handed over certain computer and video evidence to an American Muslim group who then got in touch with the FBI.
Well, let's stay overseas with you still, Rob, and talk about the U.S. and Russia. They're going to start negotiating again today in Geneva to revamp the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. The goal is to reduce the number of nuclear arms out there. What do we expect from the negotiations? Is there going to be a new tack?
Well, we keep hearing that they are very, very close indeed to an agreement. As you say, the purpose of this treaty is to get those long-range strategic warheads down to between, say, 1,500 and 1,675. At the moment, the U.S. is supposed to have just over 2,000, the Russians about 1,000. And this was always seen as perhaps the easiest thing that the Russians and the Americans could do to reset their relationship, to use that well-known phrase. I think perhaps most interestingly, you know, it may be less of a problem for Russian and American negotiators to reach an agreement than it might be to get any treaty ratified in the Senate.
Okay, that's Rob Watson, correspondent for our partner, the BBC. And Marcus, let's go back to you to wrap up here, because Paul Volcker is going to be testifying at a congressional hearing on Tuesday. Is this the man that's coming out of the Obama administration to kind of take some of the heat off of Geithner?
Well, this is very exciting. Some would say that he's displacing Geithner somewhat after the administration has not had a lot of success, or even really, you have to say, shown a lot of backbone enforcing financial reform on Wall Street, despite, you know, the huge catastrophe we faced.
And despite that Volcker was recommending all this months and months and months ago.
Absolutely. Now, suddenly, it seems, and the president came out last week with Volcker by his side, and it seems like, you know, he's going to enforce the Volcker rules on American banks. We're not totally sure what the Volcker rules are. Exactly. We're hoping on Tuesday to get more elucidation, but we hope that we expect it to be that actually commercial banks will not be able to trade nearly as much in things like derivatives and commodities.
Okay, we'll see if that happens. Marcus Mabry, International Business Editor for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks.
Thank you.
At 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in now on the top stories.
The president is unveiling his $3.8 trillion budget proposal this morning, raising the deficit to a record $1.6 trillion. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs tells CNN the budget addresses the nation's biggest concern.
Jobs are on the mind of virtually every American.
And to that end, the budget includes a $100 billion jobs bill to stimulate employment. Still, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell blames the Obama administration for ongoing weakness in the job sector.
So far, this administration has done best. What it's done best is spend, borrow, and tax, and the unemployment's gone up.
The new budget isn't all spending, though. The proposal also slashes funding to hundreds of federal programs, including projects by the Army Corps of Engineers and NASA's mission to return to the moon.
In Afghanistan, Taliban leaders have responded to a reconciliation offered by Afghan President Hamid Karzai. They say they will not consider peace negotiations with the government until international troops withdraw from the country. Karzai had this response.
On the statement of someone from the Taliban that they would talk only if the American forces withdraw, that's not a meaningful gesture.
January was the second deadliest month for U.S. troops in the war. Moving to Iraq, a female suicide bomber walking among Shiite pilgrims killed at least 41 people in northern Baghdad. And the latest on the worldwide Toyota recall, company president Jim Lentz tells NBC the company will begin shipping parts to fix those gas pedals sometime today. Coming up this morning...
It's sweet 16 for Roger.
Roger Federer wins again at the Australian Open.
Hey, you want that to go?
Good morning, everyone. Our first takeout may just be a takedown. When the White House and the Justice Department told us that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind of 9/11, would be tried in Lower Manhattan, it seemed like an immutable fact. But thanks to a local community board, maybe it isn't. Now it's widely believed that that trial will be moved somewhere else. Joining us now to tell the story and where it stands is Bob Henley, WNYC reporter, who's been all over this story. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
So, first of all, this is in many ways is a story of security concerns kind of backfiring in the face of the White House and the Justice Department. But it's also the story of a local community board here in Manhattan that turned out it could fight not only City Hall, but the White House.
Exactly. In this case, it's Julie Menon, community board chairman, number one, who wrote a op-ed piece in the New York Times Weekly Review back in January 17th, in the back page, kind of innocuous, just talking about the idea of perhaps using Governor's Island. Now, Julie Menon is also a lawyer, and she is very much in favor of the idea of a civilian federal trial, if you will. But she thought, hey, listen, let's think out of the box, and Governor's Island, being a former military installation, might be the way to go.
Right offshore, right offshore of Manhattan, just south of Manhattan, Governor's Island.
Right. Exactly. And also, at the same time, the real estate interests had gotten a look at what Commissioner Ray Kelly had in mind in terms of securing the area, and they were like, whoa, if they think it's going to take a long time to rebuild Ground Zero without this, can you imagine how hard it would be to get cement trucks in and around there? People have to understand how congested and close, actually, Lower Manhattan is.
So from the community board to the police commissioner, Ray Kelly, suddenly the mayor weighs in.
Right. He calls back on Thursday to Attorney General Holder and says, basically, let's give it another look-see. At the same time, you have to remember that Scott Brown is winning in Massachusetts,
right,
as a Republican, saying that he wants to spend all taxpayer money for weapons to fight the terrorists, not defend them. So the ground's shifting in the White House nationally, locally, and this is why all of a sudden they find themselves in a very difficult circumstance.
Well, let's listen to the sound of ground shifting under the White House. Here's White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs over the weekend.
Well, let me tell you what plan A is for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is going to meet justice, and he's going to meet his maker.
In a federal courtroom, in a military commission?
He will be brought to justice, and he is likely to be executed for the heinous crimes that he committed in killing and masterminding the killing of 3,000 Americans.
Notably, he doesn't say where. Before we go, Bob, there may be a city in New York that would love to have this trial. Explain.
Well, Mr. Valentine, the mayor of Newburgh, which is a town that's seen a lot of hard times, says, come on, we could use $100 million. I mean, it's like a blue light special. The $200 million is what they had suggested it would cost New York City in additional costs. He's like, please, we've got it all here. We've got Stewart Air Force Base. We've got Otisville Correctional Facility. This is the ultimate economic development opportunity of a lifetime.
All right, well, whether it's Newburgh or whether it's Governor's Island, we won't know. There's no real location for that trial at this point. Bob Henley, thanks so much from WNYC.
Let's go now to sports with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. This weekend down in Melbourne, Australia, we saw two tennis greats continue on the road toward domination. Serena Williams made a winning 6-4, 3-6, 6-2 win. That's her fifth Australian Open title and her 12th Grand Slam singles title overall. And for the men?
I don't think there'll be any tears from our winner. Quite simply, he is the master of the Grand Slam, and our champion for 2010, Roger Federer.
Roger Federer, that was his 16th Grand Slam title, his fourth Australian Open, by defeating Andy Murray in straight sets, 6-3, 6-4, 77-6. So, Ibrahim, is this the kind of dominance like Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods sort of dominance?
Perhaps it's even better. Roger Federer has won 4 Australian Opens, 1 French Open, 6 Wimbledons, and 5 U.S. Opens. What he can do this year at age 28 is actually run the table, win all of the 4 Grand Slams. And he has the mental focus to do it. Tennis players usually reach their peak from age 22 to 25, 26. Right now, Roger Federer is 28 years old, but this is the point where his mental capacity for the game and his physical skills are at a perfect equilibrium. He's going to play his best tennis of his life because he's prepared. Last year at the U.S. Open, you saw that mental strength diminish, and he lost the last set. Now, he's taken stock of where he was last year, and what you saw this weekend with a dominating performance over Andy Murray was the Roger Federer mentally, physically, at his best tennis ever.
So these are two, Serena Williams and Roger Federer, they've been in the game for a number of years now. How much longer can we see them continue to be winning on the courts?
You're right. Most tennis players have a 10 or 12 year window. Now we're sort of in the end of their reign, but their end of their reign is going to cement both of them as two of the greatest tennis players that ever lived.
Okay, that's sports with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
For our last takeout, let's see if we can't put to bed this issue raised by Chris Matthews about a post-racial America.
He is post-racial, by all appearances. You know, I forgot he was black tonight for an hour.
Well, not a lot of forgetting from you folks. Reactions from all over the map on what that meant.
This is Greg from Baltimore, and while I do not like the second part of Chris Matthews' statement, I do like the concept of a post-racial America. All you have to do is watch American Idol and see so many bi- and multiracial contestants. You can't tell what people are by looking at them, and quite frankly, I look forward to the day when things are so mixed up, we just judge people as individuals and can't even tell if we wanted to what they were.
I work with multiple nationalities, and racism is not a white issue. I see and have experienced racial hatred, and I do nothing and say nothing, just every day.
This is Marty from Detroit, Michigan. I find it interesting that the president himself had stated that we as a nation need to start talking about race in this country to overcome racism. Now, the few comments that have been made by Mr. Reed and reporters, the nation seems to get extremely upset, and they're light comments in nature. It just shows that we can't even begin to start these discussions.
We're always open to hearing your take on the news and how it's affecting you. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. We're always listening. Coming up...
It is critical that we rein in the budget deficits we've been accumulating for far too long.
We're going to talk about tightening the nation's economic belt as the president sends his budget to Congress. And we want to hear more from you on how what lessons you have on how to cut back. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, budget smiles and budget woes. We talk about the unveiled presidential budget in Washington and in Illinois, where there's a smiling face. But right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. Toyota told its dealers today that they should get parts to fix faulty gas pedals later on this week. But the 4.2 million drivers affected by the recall will have to wait until technicians are trained before the repairs can begin. Toyota's Jim Lentz, president of U.S. sales, offered this mea culpa this morning.
We are truly sorry for letting them down. That nothing is more important to us than their safety and their satisfaction.
Lentz says some Toyota dealers will stay open 24 hours while they fix the problem. Flights carrying injured Haitians to the U.S. for medical treatment will resume today. They'd been suspended for several days after hospitals in Florida said they were overloaded. Meanwhile, 10 Americans detained on suspicion of trying to take 33 Haitian children out of the country without proper permission will be in court today. Laura Silsby says she and the 9 other Americans thought they had all their paperwork in order.
Our understanding was is that we were told by a number of people, including Dominican authorities, that we would be able to bring the children across. The mistake, obviously, we made is we did not understand that there was additional paperwork required.
Since the earthquake, now it's required that the prime minister personally authorize the departure of any Haitian child.
Armed men stormed a party over the weekend in the Mexican border city of Juarez, killing 13 high school kids and college students. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to Dudley Althaus, the Mexico City bureau chief for the Houston Chronicle. He told us the victims had no ties to drug traffickers.
Well, a lot of them were high school football players. Some of them, one of the students that was killed, had just received an award from the state's governor for his academic achievements. These, by all accounts, were good kids.
The city of Juarez has become one of the deadliest cities in the world due to fighting among powerful drug cartels. Moving overseas, the Pakistani Taliban is denying reports that their leader died from injuries sustained in a U.S. drone strike last month. And at the Grammys last night, the competition was fierce between Beyoncé and Taylor Swift for Album of the Year, but the winner was... If you could see Taylor Swift. However, Beyoncé had the big night. She had the best night, actually, for any female singer in history. Took home a record 6 awards. Let's check on the markets now. Asian markets are up. European indices are mixed. Futures are up. The Dow will start at 10,067. The S&P at 1,073. And the NASDAQ opens at 2147. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
So it's Read 'em and Weep Day, or Read It and Weep Day in Washington. The federal budget comes out of the White House this morning. The administration unveils what looks like a record deficit in that budget. We're going to talk with Todd Zwillick in just a moment. But who's smiling and who's not about the budget cuts and the idea of a domestic spending freeze? One person who is definitely not frowning is Mike Boland, state representative in Illinois, whose district covers the Thompson Correctional Facility, which you may recall The president wants to buy to house Gitmo detainees, and the new budget, Mike Bolin, has $250 million in it to buy that facility. How are you feeling this morning?
Oh, I feel great. That's really great news. It not only will be a shot in the arm of our state budget, which, like all states, is, you know, in the deep red, but also will mean tremendous potential for jobs in an area where there's been a lot of plant closings and the unemployment and poverty is very high.
Although it's not clear that this $250 million will make it through the whole budget process, and as a Democrat there in Illinois, it's not as though anybody has to twist your vote to endorse Obama, but I'm wondering if there's any sort of political problem. I mean, it hasn't even been determined where Gitmo detainees are going to go, whether it's going to be military tribunals. There's a lot up in the air, Mike.
Well, that's very true, you know, and we don't even know for sure if any Gitmo prisoners will end up at Thompson. That was the original plan of the Obama administration. And that's fine with me and fine with most of the people here.
As long as they just buy the facility with their $250 million. Mike Boland, you said it's right. A lot of people are going to be doing exactly what you're doing, trying to run the math and figure out the numbers and determine if there's anything in the budget for them or if they need to sort of frown and sort of put it aside and maybe call the representative. Mike Boland is a Democratic state representative in Illinois. The Thompson Correctional Facility is a positive in the President Obama budget, $250 million to buy that facility. Todd Zwillick, good morning.
Good morning, John.
Once again, so that is a sort of a happy thing for one locality. You know, just broadly looking at this budget as it's unveiled, what's the sort of spending strategy that you see, the sort of fiscal philosophy behind this?
Well, spending cuts across programs that the White House thinks it can hopefully get Congress to sign on to. I really see this budget, John, as a political challenge by the president against an extremely unpopular Congress. If you think deficits are unpopular, and they are, and government spending is unpopular, and it is, the only thing more unpopular than either of these things is probably the U.S. Congress with an approval rating of around 14%, if they're lucky, maybe 15%. The president is going after some of their fiefdoms, military contracts, C-17 aircraft, engines for the Joint Strike Fighter, things that members of Congress love to spend money on. Also, remember those big, huge tax cuts from the Bush administration,
sure.
2001, sure. 2003?
They're expiring.
Expiring, and that's worth $700 billion of deficit reduction. Now, you know how that's going to be cast, not as tax cuts expiring. That's going to be cast as what? A tax increase.
So even though the president will just allow them to expire and say, hey, I didn't do anything, it's going to be cast as a tax increase. And, of course, Obama does get a $700 billion benefit.
He wants Congress to be on the hook for it. He's saying to them, look, you guys are going to preside over this tax increase so that we can start to make at least a glimmer towards balancing the budget in the long term, but he's not going to take the political hit for it. They are.
But politically, he is going after people who make more than $250,000 a year, and he is going after the banks for revenue. Explain.
He is. These tax cuts were primarily benefiting people who made $250,000 a year or more. There were also middle-class tax cuts, which the White House said yesterday are being preserved in perpetuity, at least in the president's budget. Now, of course, Congress makes the final decisions on this. It is relatively rich folks who will have their tax cuts expire if the president gets his way. And you mentioned the banking tax. You call it a fee. You call it some get-back for the taxpayers on TARP funds. That's worth $90 billion and a bit of a populist nod there for American taxpayers who were fed up with seeing Wall Street bailed out while people lost jobs.
And what did JFK say back in the 60s? We choose to go to the moon not because it is easy, but because it is hard.
Yeah.
Apparently, the Obama administration thinks it's too hard to go back to the moon. They've canceled the Constellation manned space program of NASA.
Constellation is out, which is a big program that has about 7,000 jobs down at the launch center at Cape Canaveral down in Florida.
The swing state. That seems...
In Florida.
Whoa.
The swing state, but keep in mind, we're heading into 2010, the midterm elections. I feel safe in predicting this. If we were heading into 2012, this president would have never
We'd be
proposed
going to the moon.
Cutting
We'd
a jobs program
We'd
in
be
Florida.
We'd be going to Mars. We'd be going to Jupiter.
Oh, yeah, we'd be going all the way to Neptune if this were 2012.
What about, you know, there's some other issues of cuts here that we should really talk about, and that is, I mean, we've got bank fees coming up. We've got the Moon program cut. The Army Corps of Engineers also in Florida gets some cuts.
They get some cuts there. There's a lot of spending. You know, the Army Corps of Engineers has not been popular in Washington ever since Katrina. I think you're starting to see – I think you're seeing some of the back effects of that. We will see if Congress will support the president's move to cut that even further. Another interesting place where they're cutting, John, by the way, another populist move I should point out, fossil fuel subsidies for the oil companies.
Interesting.
You would expect Democrats to want to kill those $40 billion in revenue raisers, again, if Congress goes along.
What do you think the chances that Democrat Mike Bolin there in Illinois is going to get his $250 million and buying that prison facility quickly, Todd?
It sounds like he's getting it either way. The White House kind of hedged yesterday. They said, well, the Bureau of Prisons needs it anyway, whether or not Gitmo detainees go there. So we're still buying it.
Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent, thanks so much. Coming up, keeping your finances separate to deal with budget woes in the family. Our family segment later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. As we've been reporting all this morning, a suicide bomber has killed at least 41 people in northern Baghdad. That's according to officials there. The explosion targeted Shia pilgrims as they made their way to the holy city of Karbala, south of the capital. Gabriel Gatehouse joins us now. He's a correspondent for our partner, the BBC. He joins us live from Baghdad. Good morning.
Good morning.
We've confirmed this is a female suicide bomber. What other details do we have about this attack?
That's right. We understand that a woman who'd concealed explosives underneath her clothing detonated this explosive vest at a search point where pilgrims had gathered on the way down to Karbala. The latest figures that we have from our sources in the Baghdad police are that 41 people, we think, have been killed, 106 at least wounded at this point. I think the scale of this attack really underlines the difficulties that the security forces have in trying to prevent bombings in Iraq, even though they deployed thousands of extra security people to take care of this pilgrimage heading down to Karbala. Still, this bomber managed to get through.
Now, this was part. This pilgrimage was part of a religious mourning ceremony. Was it a specific target on Shia Muslims?
It certainly looks that way, yes. This is a procession. I mean, over the next week, hundreds of thousands of Shiite Muslims will be making their way from all across Iraq and even other countries in the region, including Iran, towards the holy city of Karbala. This is one of the most important religious festivals in the Shiite religious calendar. So it certainly looks like this was a sectarian targeted attack. Now, there have been a rise in sectarian tensions here in Iraq in the run-up to elections, which are scheduled for the 7th of March, particularly surrounding a list of 500 or so candidates who've been barred from standing in that election. Now, Sunni political groups feel that they've been disproportionately targeted by this list that bars people with alleged links to Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party from standing for office. It's far too early to say whether there's any link between these two events, but certainly it's not going to help the sectarian tensions that are building up ahead of that election.
Well, officials have been saying that they expected violence to increase as we got closer to those March elections. Does that mean that they have also heightened security, perhaps to maybe stave off some more attacks?
They have indeed. I mean, the Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, is running for re-election on a platform of increased security. He says, quite rightly, that security has improved in Iraq over the past few years. Certainly, the death toll is very much down from what it was, say, two and a half years ago. But when you talk about security in Iraq, it's really a very relative concept. We just got the figures out for the death toll in January. 196 people were killed this January. That's a slight rise on January last year, and you're looking at a monthly death toll that runs into the several hundreds. Now, let's say that's roughly 10 a day. So what in Iraq is called improvements in security in any other country would really be a national emergency. So things really are very relative, and the authorities here seem to struggle with periodic attacks that do seem to get through these cordons, and whatever they seem to try, they don't seem to be able to stop the attacks full stop.
Well, I can't imagine with thousands of pilgrims walking together. That's a very easy thing to secure. That's Gabriel Gatehouse, a BBC correspondent, joining us live from Baghdad. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, we've all heard that money is among the top reasons for divorce, if not the top reason. So let's say, for example, that you keep your money separate from one spouse and another. Would that avoid that whole problem? We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. The president unveils his nearly $4 trillion budget proposal this morning. Among the new spending, a $100 billion jobs bill. But House Minority Leader John Boehner blames the Obama administration for ongoing weakness in the job sector.
We've got to change those job-killing policies if we expect the economy to get going again and put Americans back to work.
Also in the budget, cuts to hundreds of federal programs, including NASA missions to the moon and public works projects by the American Corps of Engineers, the Army Corps of Engineers, excuse me. Moving on to education, our partner, the New York Times, says the White House wants to overhaul President Bush's education law, No Child Left Behind. The White House wants to change the way the program's financed so that a portion of the money is awarded based on academic progress.
Toyota is telling its consumers that they're going to start shipping parts to fix those faulty gas pedals today, responsible for a recall of more than 4 million vehicles. Moving to some health news, British government is considering a controversial measure to cut in half the number of smokers in 10 years in that country. The solution? Sell cigarettes in packs featuring only the text of the brand and a uniform gray background for all brands. Sound effective? Tobacco companies are fighting it. BBC Business reporter Rodney Smith joined us from London to talk about it earlier this morning. My first question was how the British government's plan is supposed to reduce smoking.
I haven't a clue yet. The thing is, we're going to have to wait for Andy Burnham, who's the health secretary, to tell us. A lot of people, including the tobacco companies, are very keen to find out just what the connection is, because they're rather cynical about this. They figure it doesn't exist. They say their industry is worth $20 billion a year. That's round figures in 2008. Well, if the government wants to cut consumption, there are 20-odd... Sorry about all these numbers, but they do matter. There are 20-odd million... 20% of Brits smoke. Right. So if you cut the figure in half... for $10 billion, clearly by definition, you're going to get something like $12.5 billion cut in sales by the tobacco companies, and they're not pleased about that.
Well, Rodney, what are the trend lines right now? Is smoking declining in Britain, or is it rising?
Yes, it's declining. It's a long way from being what Americans enjoyed calling the European disease. Nowadays, it's certainly in decline. But, of course, it is. There's a reason for this. This is the cost of having a National Health Service, because of the National Health Service, by definition, you've got to reduce all the potential costs you have in the system.
Sure.
If you can keep your population, the National Health Service, healthy and well, by definition, your neighbour is and his taxes are not going to be paying for that guy's health. And so that's what we're seeing, really. That's fundamentally the process that we're seeing taking place
and
here.
The theory, yes or no, BBC Business reporter Rodney Smith, does the government have to prove a connection between drab gray and a reduction in consumption to make this stick?
Well, the tobacco companies are pretty fed up about it, and they point out that they're talking here about brands. Now, brands are actually very valuable products, and the government might find itself in a very serious legal case if it's going to try and effectively get rid of what are very well-known global brands.
At the very least, challengeable in court. Rodney Smith, the BBC reporter from London.
Pull out of the shadows and find adventure. There we are, where we are, and what we are is still family.
Okay, it's no secret that married couples argue over money, but something that's happening that is kind of a new trend is more and more couples are trying to avoid those fights by keeping their money separate. And in a survey from last year, PayPal found that 57% of couples were keeping all or at least some of their money apart. That's up 9% from 2008. So Neil Palmer joins us. He's a staff writer for Smart Money, the Wall Street Journal magazine. We also have with us Avril Nunez and Colin Miller, who've lived together for about 4 years, and they're now engaged to be married in 4 months or so. They keep separate bank accounts. So, Neil, this is a new trend of people keeping their money separate?
This is. A recession has really brought out some cracks in the relationships, and experts are seeing more financial three-ways going on. The concept essentially is you've got some money for me, some money for you, and some money for us.
And how do they determine which goes in which pile?
Well, this is the thing that couples really need to talk about. Some want everything split up jointly and then maybe have a little bit left over to play with. Others want a certain percentage, and I believe Colin and Avril both like that idea as well.
The certain percentage. Avril and Colin, you guys have been living together with 4 years, and you have kept separate bank accounts during that time.
Yes.
And now you're going to get married in 4 months, and you've decided to continue.
Yeah, I mean, it's worked perfectly for us. We don't see why we would change it.
How do you make it work?
Basically, we do a percentage, straight percentage. So 40% of our paycheck goes into the mutual, and then 60% goes into our personal bank accounts. So it doesn't matter.
So even more than goes into the joint.
Yes.
And do you do that personally, or does your bank automatically make the separation?
For me, it's direct deposit, so I don't even think about
it.
And Colin's a freelancer, so it's a little bit different for him now.
Yeah, and it actually ends up making a lot of sense for us because I have good months and I have bad months. And so as a result, I'm always putting in 40%, and it tends to kind of even out throughout a year.
Oh, you mean rather than a set amount?
Yes.
Right, exactly.
So what happens when you have kids, Colin?
Well, I mean, I think that once we have kids, we're going to have to probably increase that percentage.
Right.
And or maybe reverse it, 60-40, yeah. But we'll probably still do the percentage.
90-10.
90-10, right.
So Neil, I mean, does kids complicate this math?
Very much so, especially when you're looking at things like college tuition bills, textbooks, even just treating your kids. There was one couple in Maryland where the husband likes treating them weekly to ice cream, but yet the wife goes and treats them to a trip to New York. And so you have to make sure you set out these boundaries and say, what's going to be fair? Am I going to be currying favors from the kids more than the other, and make sure you guys are okay with whatever you establish?
Is this only for people who are, say, middle class or above? I mean, what if you're living paycheck to paycheck? Are you still going to be worrying about putting percentages in this account or that account or the other?
It certainly gets more complex if you're living paycheck to paycheck, but it's still a good idea to have a little bit of money left over, and that might just be $50 to $100 in certain situations. But it's good to have that financial independence and a bit of freedom where you can get that control.
So, Avril, give me an example. You put 40% of your paycheck into the mutual account. Mm-hmm. What does that pay for?
Pays for the rent. It pays for, you know, all the utilities. If we go out to dinner and it's just a regular dinner, groceries, all of the kind of the basic needs. And then in our personal accounts, it's, you know, if I want to buy jewelry or if I want to treat him to a nice dinner or buy him something, that's from my personal account.
You ever argued over an expense?
Yes.
Okay, explain. Let's have a story.
Well, Colin loves photography, obviously, and some of the books are really, really expensive, and he has a lot of them, but that's what he loves.
But I need them for work, Avril.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
They're tax deductible, right, Colin?
Or, you know, it's like a limited edition. There's like a series, and there's only 6 books, and it's like $2,000, and it just seems so much to me.
But this is also one of the reasons why I think this system works so well for us, is because I tend to spend more. I'm a little bit less financially responsible. And as a result, this 40% kind of is a check. And it makes sure that we're going to have everything taken care of. Avril doesn't need to worry that I'm going out and buying a big screen TV or something like that. We have everything taken care of. So we have that stability at the same time.
So wait, really? You never examine what the other person... I mean, as long as it's coming out of that personal account, he could come home with 24 table books and you wouldn't say a word because it's out of his 60%.
There's discussions.
Yeah, I mean, there still is, but it just seems, you know, I still get to get what I like, which is things that he probably thinks are unreasonable. Like, you know, I love shoes and I love accessories. So, I mean, there's a balance. You have to think about, well, that's what he likes and... You know,
Neil, what about a major expense? I mean, when they're getting to put that down payment on a house or anything else, and they don't have that much money in their joint account, where does that come from?
Well, it's interesting you bring this issue up, because with the recession, a lot of couples have been finding that one spouse is either having their hours cut at work, they're making less money, they're getting laid off.
There's a different credit rating even.
Exactly. I mean, one husband, he had his own rental properties and they ended up becoming vacant. He had to turn to his wife for the mortgage payments, when in the past 10 years, he's been taking care of that himself. So it's certainly shifting the power dynamics, and couples do need to talk about the what-if scenarios.
Okay. Well, I would imagine that when the money gets tight, it's not quite so easy to get that 40% into that bank account. Are you guys anticipating, are there certain things, Avril or Colin, that are just, you see them walk through the door with that bag and...
Well, I think it's like cyclical, you know, like he has made more money in the past and I do. I mean, it kind of varies. So the 40% is, if you make a dollar, it's still 40 cents. And I just feel like things will, you know.
And I mean, the problem, you know, part of it is, yes, you know, maybe I go out and buy things once in a while. But at the same time, I mean, we're trying to kind of, you know, build towards buying a house, you know, having a down payment, stuff like that. And so we're trying to kind of start a savings account, which will even be separate from the mutual. The mutual is like a checking, and then having a savings account in addition to that.
Okay, that's Colin Miller, a photographer, and Avril Nunez. They're going to be married in 4 months. We'll see how well that works out. Once the marriage takes place, they're keeping separate banking accounts. Neil Palmer is a staff writer for Smart Money, the Wall Street Journal magazine. Let's turn turn this over to you now. If you're a relationship, how do you work out the finances? Do you split up your money? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE.
That's how you can reach us, because we're also talking about how to tighten the nation's budget for what might be a turbulent few months. The Obama administration unveils its budget this morning. What things about your city need to stay away from a budget cut? What do you want to preserve? Tell us your priorities. Budgets are a sort of spending and philosophical blueprint politically. It's all about the money. Follow the money. Tell us what's going on in your community. And if you're at our site, you can check out our State of the Union playlist. All last week, we asked you for songs that best summed up the nation. We got all sorts of them. Look at the playlist on thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headley.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.